It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. After the fatal shooting of Green Bay High School graduate Alex Preddy by federal agents on Saturday, FBI Director Kash Patel raised concerns about Preddy's possession of a firearm on the scene.
You cannot bring a firearm loaded with multiple magazines to any sort of protest that you want. It's that simple. You don't have that right to break the law and incite violence.
And when President Donald Trump was asked by a reporter if Preddy was an assassin, he said no, but, quote, you can't have guns, you can't walk in with guns, you just can't do that. Preddy was carrying a holstered firearm and had a concealed carry permit. Videos and a preliminary Department of Homeland Security report indicate that he did not draw or brandish the firearm.
These statements by officials in the Trump administration have raised concerns from some Wisconsin Second Amendment advocates.
Tom Grieve is a former state prosecutor and Second Amendment attorney based in Wisconsin and is on the U.S. Concealed Carry Association Council. He covers these issues on his YouTube channel. Tom, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, I appreciate being here. Thanks, Rob.
And Blake Alvarenguez, founder of the Forward Initiative, which offers free firearm safety and concealed carry weapon classes in the Madison area. Blake, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, Rob.
Tom, let's first get your reaction to those comments by FBI Director Patel. Is it illegal to carry a firearm during a protest? What's your reaction?
No. You are, just to be clear for the record, you are allowed to practice more than one basic constitutional right at the same time. So First Amendment, Second Amendment, that in and of itself is perfectly okay.
Blake, as a teacher and firearm owner, what do you make of this situation with Preddy and the comments from the Trump administration, the president, the FBI director, and others pointing at his possession of a firearm as part of what incited the shooting?
Alex Preddy had every right as a Minnesota resident and as an American citizen to be concealed carrying while practicing his First Amendment rights, whether he's in Minnesota as a licensee or in Wisconsin. He had every right to be there to peacefully observe. The language coming out of the White House and the FBI are inexcusable and are everything against we have as American citizens and our rights.
Tom, what would you want to see from law enforcement, local, state, federal, when it comes to awareness of how to interact with that citizen who may be protesting? There may be a confrontation. They see that holstered weapon, but it is not drawn or used.
Yeah, I think that from law enforcement needs to obviously contextualize what's going on. If that person is, and I'm not suggesting that that is what was happening with Mr. Preddy in Minnesota on Saturday, the 24th, but if that individual is interfering with an investigation, if they are somehow breaking the law, that obviously dynamically changes the situation. Otherwise, an individual with a firearm by themselves is perfectly lawful, and law enforcement, of course, needs to be aware of that, and they need to be able to professionally approach that person and not escalate anything.
And Blake, do you want to elaborate on that? What kind of things would you like to see from that citizen with the firearm in this situation and from the law enforcement?
From what I saw and all the reports I've seen, Alex Preddy was being perfectly safe and responsible. He was licensed. He had his firearm holstered appropriately through the entire interaction. You know, you saw that it stayed secured even after he was brought to the ground by these law enforcement officers. There is nothing he did wrong.
We're talking about concealed firearms and the law. After comments from President Trump and administration officials about Alex Preddy's possession of a licensed concealed firearm when he was shot by federal immigration agents, Tom Grieve is a former state prosecutor, Second Amendment commentator based in Wisconsin, Blake Alvarenga, founder of the Forward Initiative, which offers free firearm safety and concealed carry training around Madison. Another comment from a Republican official, I want to listen to Congressional Representative Tom Tiffany, candidate for governor now. A reporter asked if people should be allowed to concealed carry at a protest. Here's a listen to his response.
If it's provided in the law in your state, yes, you should be able to conceal carry. But, I mean, you should also think about when you're going to go into a situation like that. I mean, be sure to think about the ramifications of that.
Hey, Blake, that's a different kind of answer. Yes, legal, Representative Tiffany says, but is it wise? Is it a smart decision? When you're working with people, maybe training people, Blake, what kind of advice would you give them about when and whether to have that firearm in what could be a difficult situation?
I would never advise a student to seek out confrontation, especially armed confrontation. It's irresponsible, and you never want to put yourself in a situation where anyone's life is in danger. However, from what I've seen and the reporting I've seen, Alex Preddy, maintained his distance, maintained his situational awareness. His firearm remained holstered at all times. He was communicative, and he was very clear with his body language and his actions what he was doing and what he was doing there. If a student of mine practiced and followed all the same systems as Alex Preddy, I would just be as distraught.
And Blake, as a gun rights advocate, you know that generally Republicans and Democrats are split on gun ownership and gun rights. The stereotype: Republicans oppose gun control, Democrats favor of it. What do you make of the politics of this as we look at this particular situation?
Kind of how America treats gun and gun culture. I think it's very skewed in the media and in reporting. Many Democrats, liberals, people on the left absolutely own firearms and care about firearm rights. And there are people on the right who would like to see bigger government with, the ability to disarm certain populations. I think the conversation should be more about working class people and their ability to practice the Second Amendment, whether it's in their daily life or during protests. And I think we really see that disconnect in state and federal politics.
Tom, with these comments from President Trump and the FBI director, do you worry about their consistent support for Second Amendment rights that you would be hoping that they would support?
It's certainly not what I want to be hearing, if that's what you mean. It's anything less than a full-throated endorsement of Second Amendment, regardless of the letter attached to the politician. And for that matter, not only Second Amendment, but any right is obviously concerning. That being said, with a couple checkered exceptions, President Trump, love him or hate him, if you are a Second Amendment advocate, there's no denying the fact that he has been very pro-Second Amendment on the policies as well as with his judicial appointments.
I want each of you in turn to speak to people who might be on the other side of this issue who say, carrying guns in public, the Second Amendment or not, it's inflammatory in some ways. It's going to raise the temperature, raise the risk of confrontations. Tom, what would you say to people who share those concerns?
Well, if you're carrying your firearm in public, there's obviously two ways of doing it. One is so-called open carry, where your firearm is perhaps openly holstered or slung in the event that it's a rifle or shotgun. And bluntly, I don't think that's a great idea to be going open carrying to a very dynamic, chaotic situation that's covered in law enforcement. Tensions are up and things can shift very rapidly. It's like going to observe a tornado and you're not a professional and you don't know what's going on or how to handle that. Anything can happen. Concealed carry is another matter, assuming, of course, that you're following the law. But for inflammatory, I guess I would say that I understand that, but it's really no different at the core root as somebody who's holding up a sign or a placard demonstrating and showing their core constitutional rights.
And Tom, you just reminded me of something I wanted to ask you. You talked earlier about the legality of concealed carry. What should people know about the legality of the open carry you were just talking about?
Sure. Well, in Minnesota, you require a license to either open carry or conceal carry. Here in beautiful Wisconsin, we have basically what's called permitless or constitutional carry, whereby if you are authorized as an adult to carry a firearm, in other words, there's no prohibiting factors like being a felon or having a qualified domestic abuse restraining order against you, things like that, then you're absolutely allowed to constitutional carry. There are some restrictions about the places you can go, like schools and post offices and so forth. So be sure to check your local listings on that.
And Blake, your message to people who think just having a firearm concealed or not in protest situations in public makes life more dangerous?
No, I don't think so at the root of it. People are allowed to express themselves. That said, conceal carry is definitely the way to go in most situations, especially when you're by yourself as an individual at places like a protest. Highly recommend the conceal carry. You can see from the narrative coming out of the White House and other officials that they're using it after the fact as justification. Up until Alex Preddy was brought to the ground violently. No one knew he was carrying a firearm, and his presence didn't raise tensions any more than any other of the observers.
And Blake, there have been comparisons made between the killing of Alex Preddy, people looking back at the August 2020 shootings in Kenosha, Kyle Rittenhouse carrying firearms, a protester on the other side carrying concealed firearms, ultimately two people in Kenosha killed. I understand, have some thoughts on comparing and contrasting here. Could you take a minute?
Yeah, that we shouldn't. Alex Preddy was in broad daylight observing with a cell phone, helping another observer up from the ground after they were pepper sprayed. Kyle Rittenhouse was paid to be out there by a local business. At night, there was active chaos. There should not be any lines drawn between the two. It's completely unfair. Alex Preddy never drew his firearm. He never fired a shot. The two should not be in the same conversation in America today.
And finally, Tom, can you leave us with a message? Somebody listening might be going to a place where protests or enforcement are happening. They're a concealed carry, doing that legally. Your advice for them if they find themselves in the middle of a somewhat chaotic scene?
Two things. Number one, you need to understand what your rights are. You need to understand what the law is to make sure that you don't run across any tripwires or break any laws yourself. You do need to understand that law enforcement, if you are armed, you will be treated differently. I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily fair, but it is the way that law enforcement is trained. Secondly, I would say that you need to be very cautious about when you're engaging with particularly any federal agents or federal law enforcement, that there are an enormous web, tangled web of if you do something to impede them, if you make contact with them, you could be committing a crime, even though that's not your true intention for whatever reason. So you need to be extraordinarily careful and cautious, understand your rights, understand how to raise them and use them.
Thanks to both of our guests, Tom Grieve, former state prosecutor, Second Amendment commentator, and Blake Alvarenga, founder of the Forward Initiative, offering firearm safety and concealed carry training in Wisconsin. We've been talking about Second Amendment rights in protest situations.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new federal income tax deduction for tipped workers, and Wisconsin lawmakers push for a similar tax break. A group of Wisconsin bartenders discuss take-home pay.
It's very much the customers that give us our income.
It's the guests that pay us. We're there to like get our income via them. So I'd say the tips are quite important.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Trump administration's One Big Beautiful Bill Act that became law last year instituted a federal income tax deduction for tipped wages of service industry workers.
Now, Wisconsin lawmakers are pushing a similar state tax break for tips.
The bill that would match the federal tax deduction has passed both chambers of the legislature with some bipartisan support and is headed to Governor Evers' desk for a signature.
Tens of thousands of Wisconsin workers rely on tips as part of their incomes. With tax filing season underway, we're checking in with three of them now to hear their experiences in the service industry.
Ethan Radecki is a bartender at Commodore Club in Appleton. John Coya is the head bartender and banquet captain at the Rooftop at Hotel Goodwin in Beloit. And Carly Passer is a bartender and server at Junction Pub in Milton. Welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Nice to meet
Thanks
you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Ethan, I'm going to start with you. Can you start out by giving us some idea as to how much of your income is based on tips?
I'd say it's over half of my income, at least. Usually when I'm in the service industry, I always say I try to stick with smaller companies, smaller businesses that do craft cocktails and, you know, give me an hourly rate, but that I appreciate, because really I always say it's the guests that pay us. We're there to like get our income via them. And I just try to work somewhere with a company that kind of keeps that in mind and gives me a better work-life balance rather than the money. So I'd say the tips are quite important.
Carly, how about for you? How critical are your tips to earning a living wage?
I would honestly bump it up a little bit more, even to like 75% of my income comes from tips. And I think that's kind of the case in a lot of different places that I've worked, where the hourly rate is a lot lower than people expect. But then, like he said, it's very much the customers that give us our income.
75%, that means that any fluctuations you can really feel in your paycheck at the end of the day, for sure.
Oh, 100%.
And John, how about for you? What do tips feel like? Are your, you know, wages driven by the number of customers that choose to write a tip on the tip line?
Absolutely, yeah. It's about the same for me, about 70%. It's somewhere in that range. But it definitely, especially this time of year, definitely gets a little tight with tips.
You notice changes seasonally with tips, John?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. January is usually a really slow month for tips and just people going out in general, you know, after the holidays and, you know, you got your New Year's resolutions and all that other fun stuff. So it's just a slow time of the year.
How about for you, Ethan? Do you tend to feel those differences in the season? How consistent are your wages when they're dependent on tips?
It is pretty wild how that works out usually. For example, the bar that I was at last year, the Loon Room in Milwaukee, January, we made so much more in tips than we would have thought. You know, it was really cranking at the bar, and February was really dead. So just to talk about, like, yeah, we think, oh, there's going to be a slow season. We know that January is going to be a little slower. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way. And sometimes months that you're relying on that money, it just doesn't come in, which, you know, there's some unpredictable things and things that you can't project that definitely make it weird to balance.
Carly, do you feel an added pressure to have to perform above and beyond to earn that money from customers through tips?
I think, yeah, to some extent, for sure. I think especially when you're first starting out, but once you become a server or a bartender and you work in that industry for a long time, it almost just comes natural, where for me, I don't really feel like I have to go above and beyond. It's just kind of something that is ingrained in me now. And I think if you like the service industry, it becomes an easier task. Now, when there's a difficult customer, there's a busy time, there's whatever, sure, you have to kind of go above and beyond and do the extra for those customers. But I think after a while, it just kind of becomes natural.
John, do you feel an added performance burden at the bar?
No, I kind of agree with Carly on that. After doing it for a while, it's natural. And you realize that the more you take care of the customers, the more they tip you. So it kind of just comes along with it.
John, turning to tax season, I understand you just did your taxes the other day. How much of a difference will it make for you not having a portion of your tips taxed by the federal government?
Oh, it's huge, actually. I actually over doubled my tax return from last year compared to this year, just federally.
Did that surprise you?
I knew it was going to be bigger, but the amount that was bigger was actually really refreshing and good to see.
What will you put that money toward? Did you have something in mind?
Paying off bills mostly. You know, just this time of year is just kind of slower. So just, you know, paying off bills for the most part.
Ethan, will this tax filing season feel different for you as you see this new aspect of it and, you know, not taxing a portion of your tips?
Yeah, so I did my taxes yesterday, actually. I saw a huge difference in the federal return and not much different in the state return this year. And going into it, I didn't really, you know, there's always talks about, oh, we're going to stop taxing tips, we're going to do this. I've heard a lot of things, so I didn't really have, like, high hopes or rely anything on it. But I saw, like, seriously, like a 70% increase in what I got from last year. There may be other factors. There's different places that I've been working, but I sure liked that. And if I could feel that bump in my state return, too, that'd be a huge help.
How would it help you? What might you put those extra dollars toward?
Oh, this year I am just trying to build my savings again. That's all I'm doing. Just trying to make sure we've got enough in there because, you know, 2020 has been a weird year. There's definitely been financial hiccups here and there, and just going to get back to making sure I got plenty of money in the bank in case anything goes wrong or in case I want to take a vacation or, you know, just need some time off from the bar for a week, you know?
Carly, what do you anticipate for tax season?
I'm not sure what I'm going to expect. I also worked at a different place last summer, so things are going to look a little bit different for me, but I'm excited to see what happens for sure.
We are talking about the service industry in Wisconsin and workers who rely on tips as a large portion of their income. We have three Wisconsin bartenders, Ethan Radecki from Commodore Club in Appleton, John Koya is here from the rooftop at Hotel Goodwin in Beloit, and Carly Passer from Junction Pub in Milton. John, do you think your customers fully realize how important tips are for your overall income and your quality of life?
A good portion of them do, I'm sure. And they usually appreciate their gratitude, you know.
Because you also develop relationships over time with your customers. You know about their lives. You had this one line about, you know, you're pouring care into strangers. Can you talk a little bit about that connection with your customers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've made so many good friends and made so many relationships over the years just through bartending. And it's one of my favorite parts of the job for sure.
Ethan, you've worked at different types of bars in Appleton and Milwaukee, and you even worked, you know, before that in Colorado. Have you noticed differences in how people handle tips at different types of bars or different locations, or is it pretty universal across the service industry?
When I was working in Colorado, I worked at a pretty high-paced cocktail bar, a lot of patrons coming in, a lot of stuff going on. Heavy tips every night, you know, and I definitely got taxed a lot heavier when I was there. We also got cashed out at the end of every night. We would go do a checkout in the office and we would just pretty much every credit card tip that we had, we would just be given money at the end of the night. And then we had to claim those tips to the state and federal government on the POS system before we left. Whereas now in most of the places I've been in Wisconsin, we are working, we get that paycheck, and then it's kind of taken care of for us, which can be good because, you know, there aren't as many errors. We're not worried about accidentally not claiming tips and then the IRS having a problem with it if there's any error that you made or any error that they're just predicting because they don't know anything about your income. Whereas, yeah, here it's like it's a little easier to not worry about things like that. I'd also say I've been working at lower volume places and small businesses, and that's definitely changed the type of income that I have.
In what way?
So, when you're working at a smaller bar, usually I'm working like alone, so I'm taking care of most of the guests by myself or with one other person, rather than working with like a team of 16 people.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's kind of hard to like gauge that difference. But I did notice that like I get taxed a little bit less here. Definitely wasn't really getting much of a return when I lived in Colorado. But here lately it's been less, but yeah, I still see a little bit of a return.
John, you've also worked in a number of smaller Wisconsin communities and others in Illinois as well. Have you noticed any different trends across the places you've worked?
Definitely the place you're in can dictate the type of customers you have. I used to work out in Libertyville, and it was a little bit more upscale, I guess, in general, as far as the community. And the tips were still good, but just the way the customers treat you is a little different sometimes. So I've always found it's good to find a place that you jive well and you fit in with not only just the venue itself, but the customers as well.
Oh, that's interesting that it's not just your coworkers, but the customers also make that environment. And you have to look at both in order to ensure that you're working in the right place for yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Carly, you've also served food you're also serving food at your bar in Milton. Have you seen a difference? Does that tips you receive compared to customers who are only tipping on the cost of drinks?
It kind of varies for sure. I think the customers that come in and all they're doing is drinking, in my experience, I think they tend to tip higher. There's obviously the customers that only come in and eat food, and you're going to have the few that'll tip really well, and the ones that don't, they just tip the average. But I think from what I've noticed, yeah, I think the people that are just drinking tend to tip a little bit more.
Ethan, has the service industry gotten better or worse overall since the COVID pandemic years?
Since the pandemic, there's definitely a decline in like younger people drinking in certain parts of the country. So that'll always affect it. Sometimes for the better, because sometimes, you know, the 21-year-old people haven't been to the bar. They don't necessarily have the same quote unquote like bar etiquette. So I'm not getting like younger people who don't understand that we do rely on these tips, and that, you know, we do kind of expect, you know, somewhere in the 18 to 25% range of gratuity. But that being said, now that I'm in Appleton, there's definitely, you know, I'll get the customers who kind of come in, get the sticker shock, because they're like, oh, we don't usually go to a craft cocktail bar, and this is a little bit different. I'm used to paying, you know, $3 or $4 for my vodka soda, and here it's a little bit more. But obviously, at Commodore Club, all of our rails are not, they're not just standard rail spirits. Like we try to have everything. We try to have quality spirits and quality options for everything. So I'd say that's more where I see the difference in tipping. But we do have a lot of those regulars, a lot of those people who are yearning for that quality of thing that isn't quite as prominent in this part of the state. They come in regularly and they definitely appreciate it and tip towards, you know, more than I would expect, definitely towards the higher percentile. So that's kind of where I see the imbalance.
John Coya, from your view in Beloit, what do you wish that more customers knew about your job and what you do?
You know, it's working. I'm also at a higher end kind of craft cocktail place. So the people that are coming up to the rooftop typically are pretty well informed what they're getting into up there. It's, you know, it's high end, better atmosphere. Like we have this, again, we have upgraded rails too up there. So for the most part, it's great. But then there's a few customers that just kind of, you know, they just don't understand like the whole craft cocktail atmosphere. But we have a lot of other stuff they could drink too, you know. So,
Carly, what are your thoughts? What do you wish more customers understood about the work you do?
I think I wish they knew that it's a lot of multitasking. It's a lot of remembering orders, remembering drinks, remembering, you know, everything that's going on in that situation in that moment. But then also the service industry can be a career for a lot of people. And some people want that to be their career. I personally, that was my trajectory. That's what I wanted for my life, was to stay in the service industry in whatever capacity that I could. And I veered off of that just slightly, but I still see myself in the service industry as long as I can possibly do it, because I love it so much. And I think that sometimes I get the comments from people, you know, what's your other job or what's your real job? And I think I kind of wish that some customers would realize that, you know, I am good at my job because I actually enjoy it, and it is something that I want to continue doing.
How does that make you feel when you get those comments? You know, what is your other job or what is your real job?
It's not the greatest feeling for sure, but I come from a really small town, so I'm kind of used to the environment. I'm used to the people. I'm used to those kind of comments of the, I think smaller towns can be a little bit more judgmental when it comes to just that kind of environment, because they know everybody. Everybody knows everybody. And yeah, it does kind of hurt my feelings a little bit, but you know, it's also one of those things where as a bartender, you can kind of have that banter back and forth, and I'm able to kind of brush it off in that way.
John, you wrote this impassioned speech on the cusp of 2026 that you posted to Facebook about the love you have for your profession. What are some of those emotions that bubble up?
Oh yeah, that was. I like making the moments happen between not just me and the customer, but between other customers too, and just having that atmosphere where people can just relax and enjoy their time. It's one of my favorite things, and just that atmosphere of conversation and conviviality, and just, you know, all the good stuff that being at a really good bar is about, you know.
If tips weren't accepted, if you had a set wage, would you do what you do?
I'd have to be a lot higher wage than they're normally paying right now. I'll just say that.
What about for you, Ethan? How do you feel about that question?
Well, definitely to make it sustainable for anybody, it would have to be a higher hourly wage. But mm-hmm. I think if we were compensated in that way, yeah, it's something that I love. I started off not being a bartender. I was just making drinks at home. I was working in kitchens. And then when 2020 came around and we couldn't get a drink anywhere, I started making drinks at home and I realized it was something I loved. And that's why I went for it. I like to do what I like for a living. And that's very near and dear to me, very important. And so I guess in a short answer, yes, this is what I want to be doing. This is what I would be doing. But obviously if we took away the tips, if we took away that without a higher standard hourly rate, it would not be sustainable.
Well, Carly, John, and Ethan, thank you so much for sharing about your profession. Thank you for joining us.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. Thanks so much.
That is Ethan Radecki, a bartender at Commodore Club in Appleton. John Coya, head bartender and banquet captain at the Rooftop at Hotel Goodwin in Beloit. And Carly Passer, a bartender and server at Junction Pub in Milton. They were with us to share their experiences with tipped wages as state lawmakers consider removing income taxes on tips. And as the federal tax filing season is underway with new deductions on tips and overtime. And if your career is heavily reliant on tips, share what you're experiencing at tax time and what the mix of tips and wages are like in your industry. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, in the 1930s, a Wisconsin artist named Herb Bartlett painted murals in a Superior funeral home. Over 90 years later, they are restored.
I just thought, oh my gosh, this is a treasure, and whatever needs to be done, they have to be saved.
Bringing landscape murals back to life in Superior, that's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In the 1930s, a traveling artist from Barron in northwestern Wisconsin painted five mural landscapes inside a funeral home in Superior. The paintings and the artist were largely forgotten until recently.
The new owner of the Ogden Street building discovered the murals while renovating the space and was struck by the art on the walls.
Our next guests tell us what goes into restoring 90-year-old paintings and tell us what they can about the original artist, Wisconsin-born Herbert Bartlett.
Teddy Moronic is a retired librarian who researched the artist after the murals were discovered. Teddy, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Bill Getty is here, a retired art teacher who restored Herbert Bartlett's murals. Getty was named Artist of the Year last year by the Superior Council for the Arts. Bill, welcome.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much.
Bill, let's start with you. How did you get involved with this mural project?
I got a phone call 15, 16 months ago to come and take a look at these murals. And I walked into this shop, and I saw these five murals, and oh my goodness, they were a disaster. And I brought a colleague of mine from UMD. I worked up at the Tweed Museum at the campus of University of Minnesota Duluth. So I brought her with me to take a look at these murals. And we walked out of the building and stood at the curb and looked at each other and said, man, we don't want anything to do with that project. Those things are a disaster. And so I didn't hear anything for, better part of a year. And then I got a phone call and they asked me if I would come in and take a look at them again and make a decision one way or the other. And so I went in there and I don't say no very well. And so I undertook the project.
What made these landscapes such a disaster? What was their condition like?
Oh, my. Well, the building was an electrical shop, and that area was used basically for storage The roof leaked. There was plaster. There was plaster. Pieces of the painting were missing, down to the bare lath. Cracks ran through, multiple cracks ran through every single one of them. The walls were just sooty and filthy. And in one instance, one of the murals, it was very difficult to even tell what the subject matter was because it was that grungy, if I can use that term.
Wow. Teddy, how would you describe these landscape paintings in this building that dates back to 1890?
Well, I walked in there with a different idea than Bill. I just thought, oh, my gosh, this is a treasure. And whatever needs to be done, I don't care how much it costs. Well, I wasn't paying for it, but something has to, they have to be saved. I mean, they were in terrible condition, but I thought, the first thing that came to my mind was who did them and why? And obviously, the first thing I looked for was a signature on the paintings, and I found one, amazingly. So at least we could attribute it to somebody. But I didn't know about them. I know Bill didn't know about them. They were the best kept secret in Superior, for sure. So, and to see them, you just thought, these deserve to be saved. And there's a story behind these pictures.
Bill, what do the murals depict?
Well, there were five different landscapes. One of the landscapes was local. It was of the Solon Springs, and Teddy can maybe address that a little bit more. But the other four were, there were landscapes, but they didn't appear to be local at all.
Okay, and so, Teddy, you were able to figure out that one of these murals is apparently the mortician's, you know, summer home in Solon Springs. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. And the reason, the only reason I found out that it was his summer home is that the Superior Public Library actually has a photograph of the house.
Oh.
And I can remember going through the photographs at the library one day after I'd seen the murals, and I thought, I looked at it and I thought, this looks really familiar. And then I realized it was the picture, you know, it was the house that was in one of the murals. So that was a great, like, fact that I found out that sort of led to why were these painted. You know, and the other ones, I agree with Bill, they don't, in some respects, they look like areas around here, but they could be probably anywhere. And I'd love to know where he got his inspiration to paint the rest of those pictures.
Isn't there a windmill in one of them?
There is. And, you know, Douglas County has the Davidson windmill. But the windmill in the painting looks nothing like the real windmill. So unless he was taking artistic license.
Teddy, you tried to learn more about Herb Bartlett and how these murals came to be. What did you learn about this traveling artist?
Well, I learned that he was sort of a nomad. He was everywhere. And I honestly can say from north to south, east to west in the United States, trying to earn a living painting, not only as an artist, but as a sign painter. He painted in a theater in northern Minnesota. He had, done things all across Wisconsin, sign painting, probably any way that he could get a job. And then he came to Superior in about 1931, got involved in the local arts community. He taught some classes at a local conservatory of art and music. He decorated Mr. Gennard's new building for his grand opening. He did all of these things. And I believe the reason he painted these murals was, I've never been able to find a story about them. They've never been cited in the newspaper anywhere. But there was a funeral directors convention in Superior in 1933. And Mr. Nickel, he owned the funeral parlor. And I believe he did this because he was on the committee for this convention. They were, you know, funeral directors from Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Upper Michigan. And I think he did it to stiff up his place. And he hired her. And the murals are in what was actually the casket viewing room, where you could go and pick out your caskets.
Ah.
So I don't know. that's my theory. Anybody can debunk it if they'd like to.
It's one way to jazz up a place, right? We're talking about murals in Superior that were rediscovered and restored last year. Teddy Moronic researched the original artist, and Bill Getty is a retired art teacher who restored them. Bill, how did you go about restoring these murals? Can you take us through the process?
Well, the first thing we had to do was to clean them. They were just absolutely filthy. And so we started out, we weren't quite sure what medium Herb used, but back in that era, casein was the preferred mural paint. It was relatively inexpensive. It was very durable. It was milk-based paint.
Like, and, milk, milk you drink based paint?
Well, from what I understand, yes.
Okay.
And so we started the cleaning process very, very carefully because we weren't sure how durable the paint really was after all these years. So we started out with distilled water and little women's cosmetic, round cosmetic pads. And inch by inch, we started to remove the soot and the filth off these murals. And, you know, they started to brighten up a little bit. So we thought, you know, we can, and we didn't see any damage to the paint from the cleaning process. And so we were able to clean them. And some of the paintings need to be cleaned more than once because they were really, really bad. But once they got cleaned, then I had to deal with the cracks, the missing plaster. And in addition to being a teacher, I'm also a drywall taper.
Oh.
So fortunately, I had that skill so I could fill in the areas that were missing and repair the cracks. And then once all that was done, then the matching of the paint and filling in the missing, there was a lot of paint that had flaked off as well. A lot of void areas that had no paint on. So we were able to start to put brush to the murals.
How difficult was it to replicate, you know, the artist's style and also pay homage to the paint itself?
Well, that was actually the easiest part. And that was the fun part. Like any job, the preparation is always, you know, the difficult part. The painting part was very, very easy for me. That was a real treat to do. I was fortunate enough to have a great mentor by the name of Tony Jaworski, and Teddy knows a lot about Tony as well. But Tony was a regional artist in Superior in the area, and he taught in the Superior Public School District for 42 years, and then he also taught adult night classes for 46 years. So when I was a kid back in the early 70s, I had Tony as my teacher at Superior Senior High School, and I learned a great deal from Tony as a student. But then later in life, I painted with Tony the last, about 15 years that he was alive. And of course, being an adult now, I paid much more attention. So, Tony taught me a great deal about color theory and, you know, all that stuff. So the painting process was very simple.
Well, you must have had a lot of patience in the cleaning aspect of it. How long did it take for you to finish restoring the murals?
Well, it took me 2 months. Hmm. I started, the last day of April, and I finished on July 3rd. But, and I didn't work every day, but I put in some days 6-8 hours, other days 3-5 hours. But,
Teddy, whatever became of Herb Bartlett?
Well, he left Superior in about 1935, and then he traveled around the United States once again. I've found references to him being down south on the East Coast. And then he finally made his way back home to Barron, Wisconsin, and he lived there until he died.
What more might you find out about this mural and his work as a Wisconsin artist?
I don't know, because I've really gone above and beyond in this one because he interested me so much. And I'd like to say about Bill, too, is that how beautiful he made those pictures look. And I was aware of Bill's work because, you know, I worked at the Superior Public Library, and the library has murals. We have Carl Gaboy murals and also Tony Jaworski murals that were recently acquired and had been rolled up and stored away in a closet. And Bill came to the library and he restored them. And you really cannot tell where Tony's work starts and Bill's, you know, where Tony's work ends and Bill's start, because they're just amazing. But, you know, finding information about Tony Jaworski is very easy, but poor Herb Bartlett, he really never had any, notoriety during his life. Although the two of his paintings that are in the McDonald Lodge are still there after all those years, when they were put up probably about 1914. So, you know, his legacy does live on.
Bill, what does it mean to you to have brought these paintings back to life?
Well, I'm very happy that I was part of that process. They're historic paintings, my goodness, and I'm very happy that somewhere along the line somebody didn't look at them and just paint over them, and you know. But Jeff Dorfman, who owns the building, saw something special in these, and I'm very grateful that he was, had the foresight to say, wait a minute, I think we have treasures here, and so he decided to begin the process of restoration. It's Jeff Dorfman's building that he's actually going to start some art classes in there. You drive by and the lights are on, and Jeff would be delighted to bring you in and welcome you and show you the murals.
Teddy, it sounds like a really great place to bring community together to do more art.
Oh, I hope so. And I truly believe that there are other murals out there that we have not discovered yet. I hope this sort of starts a trend. If, who knows? I mean, nobody knew that these murals existed. And I'm thinking, are there other places where people don't even think about it, but there's something there that pertains to our history? It'd be wonderful to find out.
Well, Bill, get more distilled water on hand.
Yes.
He's an amazing artist. And I mean, when he called me, I can't remember if he called me or texted me and told me he was there. It was his last day working on the murals and I should come down and see them. And when I walked in that place, I thought, I couldn't even believe what they looked like. So, I mean, hats off to Bill. He's an artistic gift to Superior, Wisconsin.
Thank you, Teddy.
And what a gift to have these preserved now in Superior. That must feel really good, Bill.
Well, I hope people go to the shop and enjoy them, because they are a treasure. And, it was a very, very fun and interesting project. And Teddy and I and Jeff, we all learned a lot from this thing. So it was a really great venture.
Well, Bill and Teddy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the story.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting us.
That is Teddy Moronic, a retired librarian in Superior who researches local history, and Bill Getty, a retired art teacher who restored the landscape murals of Wisconsin artist Herb Bartlett. The five murals were discovered in a building in Superior that dates back to 1890.
A family caregiver provides essential care for a loved one with a chronic illness or disability, or who may have age-related limitations, and the work of these family members is sometimes in the shadows, going unrecognized and lacking a support system.
On a future program, we'll learn about a new exhibit called In Care Of that seeks to give voice to this group of people.
And we want to know, do you have experience being a family caregiver? Are you caring for someone now? What are your days like? How do you juggle this unpaid role with other commitments? And where have you turned for support or respite?
Email us your story about caregivers. The address is wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Lauren Cox, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.